Welcome to 2024. With the 2024 election on the horizon, the wars in Gaza and Ukraine, and numerous other foreign policy and domestic news stories, it's never been more important to stay informed. The DSR Network has you covered, with experts across all of these stories, to bring you the analysis and commentary of the stories that matter. Later this month, the DSR Network will introduce the TNR Daily, featuring Greg Sargent, formerly of the Washington Post and a close friend of the show. Don't miss a moment of our coverage. Become a member of the DSR Network today. Members receive exclusive bonus content, the opportunity to attend DSR live events, a members-only Slack community, an ad-free listening experience, and more. For the month of January, receive 50% off your first year of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code DSR2024 at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code DSR2024. Thank you for your support.
Hi, this is Riley Fessler. Iran has been making headlines for rising tensions with both the U.S. and regional actors. Our episode from the archive this week is a look back at the disastrous policies towards Iran of the Trump administration, and how the Biden administration was left to pick up the pieces. Please enjoy.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf, coming to you from New York City after a long holiday weekend that included for some of us not one but two holidays. Unbelievably festive, going from Thanksgiving to Hanukkah. And here we are now back in the home stretch to all the big holidays at the end of the year. And I'm very pleased to be joined by, in California, Corey Shockey of the American Enterprise Institute. How you doing, Corey?
I am fat and happy after Thanksgiving.
Oh, that hits too close to home. Glad you're happy. You certainly don't look like any the worse for wear. And I hope you had a good holiday. Also, noted holiday hostess Rosa Brooks in Alexandria, Virginia. How are you doing, Rosa?
I'm very good, David. We got rid of the last leftovers yesterday, and I am happy.
And when you say leftovers, are you referring to guests or food?
I shoveled the last bit of mashed potatoes out of the fridge.
I see. And I have inside information that David Sanger, I think in Vermont, is still working on his leftovers. How was your holiday, David?
It was very good. I have a few of those leftovers, you know, just sitting just out of camera range here so that we don't have to remind everybody on our podcast here that they too have leftovers sitting in the fridge, except, of course, for Rosa.
Yeah, although because we celebrated Hanukkah yesterday, we got a big order of all different kinds of smoked fish from Russ and Daughters, famous emporium of smoked fish in New York. And it's great to have the refrigerator filled with that stuff. No guilt at all. Anyway, a story broke a little bit before we went on the air that the Israeli government has told the United States government that the Iranians have sped up progress on enrichment of uranium and that they are now weeks away, according to Barak Gravid's report on what the Israelis said, from being able to hit the 90% weapons grade level of enrichment of the uranium. David, you've been reporting on this story for a while, and it all seems more relevant as we enter into another round of negotiations on this Iran deal. What do you think the state of play is right now?
The only surprise out of that is that anybody is surprised. The Iranians have been ramping up their maximum pressure campaign on the United States in advance of the talks that began today in Vienna. Of course, the U.S. isn't actually sitting at the table at those talks because the Iranians won't speak with them since President Trump pulled out of the deal 3 years ago. So this is all being done through the Europeans. It's what's politely referred to in diplo speak as indirect negotiations. Means I tell you you something and you tell somebody else something, and it's not a great way to.
It's like a really fancy game of telephone.
It is, and if it didn't involve nuclear weapons, probably a game of telephone would be fine. But since it does, it's a problem. So where are the Iranians? They've been enriching uranium at a level of 60%. You need 90% in order to have something that is bomb grade. But 60% is like if you did this on a football field, just to pick out a Thanksgiving era bit, it would put you on the 90-yard line. So yes, it's probably just a few weeks to be able to get to bomb grade material. That does not mean that you are a few weeks from a bomb, which would require a lot more engineering and probably a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years of work. But the Israelis are in a position right now of saying, we don't want the old deal put back together, but they haven't yet suggested what would replace that. So, you know, I think they're looking for some freedom to go continue their sabotage campaign. I reported last week with three of my colleagues that United States intelligence position on the Israeli campaign is that while it is tactically successful, that is, every few months they've managed to go in and blow up a new facility or two, it is strategically not successful, which is to say the Iranians have sort of built this into the plan and they are rebuilding their facilities as fast or faster as the Israelis are blowing them up. And when they rebuild them, they're rebuilding them with more sophisticated equipment that can enrich to a higher level. So the question is, are we actually accomplishing much with the sabotage campaign? And is it possible to get back to the old deal? And that's looking increasingly unlikely because the Iranians are demanding two things I don't think Joe Biden can give them. The first is they are demanding that he lift all sanctions, not just nuclear-related sanctions, but all other sanctions. And second, that he guarantee that no president in the future would go off and do what Donald Trump did in 2018, which is abandon the deal. And Biden can't tell you who's going to be president in 3.5 years or whether they would abide to this deal or not.
That's true. I mean, when you think of all the weight that Mike Pompeo has lost, Corey, it's clear he wants a chance to blow up this deal again if it ever happens, because he looks like he's grooming himself for a run at the presidency. And he's just one of the candidates who might undo anything Biden did.
Could I ask, David, what's going on between the Iranians and the UN about inspections?
So the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the UN arm of this, went to Iran a number of months ago and thought he had worked out an agreement about where inspectors would be allowed and equipment that the Iranians would keep operating or preserve data from. It turned out the Iranians did not abide by that. And in one of the facilities in particular that the IAEA is concerned about is a manufacturing plant for centrifuge parts that the Israelis, we believe, helped blow up a number of months ago. And when they blew it up, they not only blew up a good number of the centrifuges, they blew up some of the cameras and sensors and other inspection equipment. So the Iranians said, tough luck, you're not getting that back. And of course, the inspectors want to find out what's coming out of that plant as they get it back up and running again. So we're going into the situation where we're increasingly blind. And that's worrisome because if there was diversion of equipment or materials to someplace we don't know about in Iran, you wouldn't know that from looking at the equipment.
Basically, like the Iranians are saying, every time the Israelis blow up a plant, they're saying, we never liked that plant anyway. We've got a really good insurance policy.
Or we can rebuild it. It's what somebody referred to me as Iran's Build Back Better.
You know, a couple of days ago, a friend of ours, friend of this podcast, Alan Pincus, sent me an article from Aretz in which it was observed that a number of people who were around Bibi Netanyahu when he was urging Donald Trump to get out of the Iran deal, including a former Mossad chief, a defense minister, and an IDF commander, are now speaking out against the decision of having gotten out of the deal for some of the reasons we've just touched upon. The former defense minister called the decision to pull out of the deal, a decision he supported at one time, the main mistake of the last decade in Iran policy. And Corey, if David's prognostication here is right about the future of the deal, it may get worse from here. Interesting to have these Israelis change their tune, although it has also led some other Israelis to start banging the drum for harsher measures against Iran, including attacks. My former college roommate, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, had an article in the Times of Israel a couple of days ago in which he said it may be time to attack, in a way presumably different from the small attacks to which David is referring. What do you think of this intellectual turmoil around this deal in Israel, Corey?
So I always feel like Prometheus watching his vultures descending when the Israelis tell us what we ought to do. I seem to recall them thinking the invasion of Iraq was a good idea before the invasion of Iraq, and being scolded by Israelis afterwards that we had managed to enable Shiite domination of Iraq in the aftermath, which would have been more helpful before rather than after the event. And I feel the same about this. I think it's true that it was a bad idea to leave the Iran nuclear deal. I also think the Israeli government was adamantly in favor of us doing that. So, I mean, we need to make our own decisions. We need to take into account the concerns of our allies, but I wouldn't put too much weight on it because I think very often people have Damascene conversions after they're not responsible for the consequences of things. I can think of, for example, former Defense Secretary Bill Perry being for the abolition of nuclear weapons in retirement that he never was when Secretary of Defense or in other responsible positions. It's important to listen to what allies have to say. It's even more important to listen to what allies responsible for consequences have to say, so that the Israeli government isn't saying that about the Iran deal. I think we have to take even more consequentially. That said, I am not in favor of our Iran policy. I wasn't in favor of Trump administration Iran policy. I wasn't in favor of Obama administration Iran policy. I wasn't in favor of Bush administration Iran policy, because I think we have two things wrong. The first is threatening to destroy the Iranian nuclear program, which I do not believe any of those presidents were actually willing to do. And the one thing I noticed about America's adversaries, in particular Russia and Iran, that they are terrific at plying the gap between what we claim we are going to do and what we are actually willing to do in the world. And so I think it's literally incredible for us to take that policy. A better policy would be one that, as a country gets close to crossing the nuclear threshold, so I'm in favor of all of the non-proliferation measures to keep countries from getting close to the threshold. But once they are at the threshold, I think a better policy is to diminutize the achievement. That is to say, whether or not Iran has nuclear weapons, any attack by Iran on the United States or its allies would lead to the destruction of the Iranian political and military leadership, because that's a threat I think they would take seriously and that we might actually be willing to carry out.
Corey, isn't that exactly what the U.S. moved to with North Korea? For years, they said, we will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea. We will not tolerate. Okay. Then they did 6 nuclear tests. And then our position changed to, if you ever used them or proliferated them, you'd really regret it.
Yeah, but in fact, the historical record proves we will tolerate it. And tolerating it is actually a better choice than war over a nuclear program that we don't actually understand the motivations and for which there is a perfectly plausible, this will keep the United States from attacking us motive. It makes the international order more dangerous, more unstable. It makes our diplomacy harder. But I actually do think it is preferable to tolerate a North Korean nuclear program than to go to war to destroy North Korea's nuclear program.
Rosa, does the Biden administration have any good options here?
Well, they have been trying the old, you know, close your eyes, click your heels together and spin around and chant Jigpoa, Jigpoa, Jigpoa three times. But I think they must be doing something wrong. I think maybe they forgot the candles or something because it doesn't seem to be working. No, I mean, I think Corey's 100% right. I mean, when you demand something that is unrealistic because you're not actually prepared to do what it would take to enforce it, and it's good that you're not actually prepared to do what it would take to enforce it because it would be crazy to go to war over this, you know, then you put yourself in a weaker position. I mean, we have put ourselves in this position. Trump has made it much, much worse, needless to say. We're in a bad position now because of overly bellicose U.S. pronouncements that we were not prepared to back up for a very, very long time. I also think, maybe I'm wrong, but David, you had shared with us earlier the article by your former roommate, and we hold you fully responsible for everything he says and does, former ambassador from Israel to the United States, suggesting that Israel cannot tolerate Iran even reaching the so-called threshold of being able to create nuclear weapons, and that this time, you know, Israel really would do something with unspecified threat, but a threat would be much more aggressive than they have been, potentially use bunker busting technologies that they may or may not actually have, we don't know, and that they don't care what the U.S. thinks because they can't tolerate Iran having the ability to make a nuclear weapon quickly, for the simple reason that that's too fast and then they might use it. I can't conceive of the Iranians deciding preemptively to use a nuclear weapon against Israel, right? That would be a way to guarantee cataclysm and war and the destruction, not only of the Iranian regime, but of many of the people of Iran. I don't think they want to do that. As Corey suggests, if they had nuclear weapons, yes, it's complicated. Yes, it's dangerous. Yes, it would be nice if there were fewer countries in the world that had nuclear weapons, but they, like all the rest of us, with the exception of Donald Trump, to whom is an exception to all rules, would say what we all say, which is that we can't possibly afford to use this preemptively because that would be the end, so let's not. The argument that Israel is in fact in greater danger doesn't really make any sense to me. And I do worry about, you know, it does sound like the Biden administration is trying to politely be a little tougher with the Israelis to say, do not do this, you jerks. This is not going to help. You know, and in fact, so far, you may arguably have been just making things even worse or at least complicating things. Will that be effective? I don't know. What happens if Israel really does take preemptive action that escalates well beyond the intermittent assassinations and intermittent targeted strikes? I don't know. But I do think that we are where we are. I actually think it is a sign of a good leader to undo a bad policy. It's a sign of a bad leader to undo a perfectly good policy that's working for no reason other than to give the finger of his predecessors, which is what the Trump administration did in pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. But I actually think for Biden, his administration, you know, a good leader is able to say, you know what, we've been pursuing a policy that hasn't been working for either us or the Iranians. You know, let's really think hard about whether we need to stick to this. Oh, you can't possibly, we won't let you. It's a red line. Given that we know that this doesn't make sense and it hasn't been working, let's try something different. I would regard that as good leadership, but I have a feeling that the White House will view itself as politically unable to shift positions at this stage, which means that we're all going to stay boxed into our respective corners.
So, David, I think Corey, who's apparently, you know, anti the, you know, Iran policy of all of our recent presidents, has described an approach that makes some sense. And as you say, it's akin to the approach that has been our position with regard to the Koreas. But as Rosa points out, this is different from that position because the Israelis are a wild card. And while I don't want to in any way minimize the threat Iran poses or the bad behavior of Iran throughout the Middle East, the reality is that the Israelis have made a number of moves here which have made the situation more complicated. And I might add provocatively that begins with them getting a nuclear weapon first. But even setting that aside, their views regarding the JCPOA complicated it. And now we could, you know, find somebody taking a perfectly sensible position, such as the one Corey describes, but not being sure how do you contain the Israelis and keep them from doing something that it would be hard for us to defend and hard for us to condemn. How do we deal with that, David?
Even harder than that, David, it would be hard for us to condemn. It would be hard for us to defend. And it would be hard for us not to get drawn into whatever happened next. And let's say the Israelis did do that and did do a broad attack on the Iranian facilities, which they came close to doing twice during the Obama administration. And let's say the Iranians respond because your territory can't be bombed without you responding. If there's escalation, you know, clearly we're going to have to come at some point to Israel's aid, or in some way we might have to defend shipping in the Gulf and so forth. So in most of the simulations where this sort of plays out, and American officials have done this dozens of times trying to play this out, we usually get sucked into this kind of conflict. And so part of the warning that's going on between the Biden administration and Israel is, don't do something that's going to go get us sucked into another Mideast war at a moment that you notice that President Biden is trying to extract us from the region and focus on China and so forth. I also think it's entirely possible that we are going to have to go to the fallback position that Corey describes. We went through time after time in the Bush administration, in which, to my memory, Corey, you served, where President Bush kept saying to us, I will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea. I will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea. And one day at a press conference, I said to him, they've just done some nuclear tests. It strikes me you're tolerating it. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm putting sanctions on them. Well, we've put every sanction on Iran we can think of. Part of the Plan B strategy the Biden administration wants us to think about is what additional sanctions you could go put on Iran. I'm sure there are some. I'm also sure they probably wouldn't be a whole lot more successful at deterring Iranian action than the last 1,500 sanctions we have put on Iran. So the administration at this point is somewhat out of good options. And that's why I think over time, they may well have to turn to the kind of strategy that Corey just described, which is to say, okay, you have a nuclear capability or at least a turnkey capability. In other words, I don't think the Iranians will build the bomb. I think they will walk right up to the edge of it and then issue the warnings about what happens if they ever used it or exported it.
Thank you for that compliment that every policy in the Bush administration was amenable to my influence. Oh, that it had been true.
It wasn't? Wow.
We would all be better off, certainly, were that the case. We'll come back in a moment. And when we do, I'd like to talk a little bit about whatever options do exist within the context of the diplomatic discussions that are taking place. For the moment, those of you who are leaving us, join us again soon. We've got a lot coming up, including a big episode on the current new variant of COVID, which will come out on Thursday. And I encourage you to listen to that, as well as conversation with Martin Indyk later this week about his new book about Henry Kissinger in the Middle East. So we've got a bunch of interesting programming. So if you're leaving us now, thank you for joining us, and follow what we've got coming at thedsrnetwork.com. And if you're staying with us, we'll be back in one moment. So we are back. Corey, we've described a bunch of reasons why the negotiations in Europe might not work with regard to salvaging the JCPOA. We've also described a bunch of options post-JCPOA, which might not be so great. Do you think, despite the fact that David has kind of ruled out a successful negotiation, there might be some diplomatic masterstroke that could make everybody pleased, you know, lifting a little more sanctions than we wanted to, but less than they wanted, et cetera, et cetera. Or what should the State Department be trying to get done here rather than just throwing up our hands in resignation that we can't make it better?
Well, I do think it was a mistake for the Biden administration to suggest that in addition to getting Iran back in the nuclear deal, they were also going to get agreements on terrorism, regional stability, interdiction of shipping, all of the other things Iran is doing bad for the international order and also bad for the Iranian people, especially where human rights depredations are concerned. I do think that was a mistake, but they still have lots of running room. And I would hope an administration that says it's putting diplomacy first wouldn't just throw their hands up, but would do several things. First, I think, is to persuade the European participants in the 3+1 negotiating format, 3+2, I can't remember the appropriate designation, but us, the Europeans and the Iranians, to get the Europeans to threaten to put sanctions back on if the Iranians don't return to the terms of the JCPOA, because it was actually, as David points out, American sanctions have been extreme for a long time now. It looks to me like it was actually Europeans, China and Russia, joining into the sanctions regime that had brought Iran to the table in the first place. So first port of resort is to the Europeans. Second port of resort, I think, should be us and the Europeans jointly going to China and Russia to try and get those sanctions back in place. You know, one thing the United States appears to have forgotten in the Trump administration is that negotiations mean you actually have to give something up, that you can't just go in with your list of demands and anticipate that others will compromise what they are doing or their own interests in order to make us successful. So we ought to be thinking about what we can and should be giving to get them back. And that will be a salutary lesson for future American presidents, that doing things like leaving the Iranian nuclear deal have costs to the United States. It should be obvious, but it's evidently not. Evidently was not to Mike Pompeo and others in the Trump administration, that leaving a deal that every American intelligence agency said the Iranians were abiding by was in fact a bad choice. Other things I think they should be doing, thinking about things we could give the Iranians as part of a future deal. Are there things the Iranians want that we can actually give them? Also, how to use the actual advantages of free societies, transparency and accountability, in ways that drive up the cost to the Iranians of the things they are doing that we don't like them doing, and getting others to help us in that transparency and publicity. So I think there are lots of things that we can and should be doing in addition to focusing on how to get the deal started again. I think, for example, we ought to have the American Secretary of State pacing the corridor outside the negotiations to demonstrate to everybody that we're willing to talk, even if the Iranians won't. We need to think more about cost-imposing strategies that, even if they don't bring us back to the nuclear deal, make clear that we're repentant of our mistakes and want a better arrangement than our own choices have gotten us.
So, Rosa, all that makes a lot of sense to me. Do you think we should have Corey over there as the negotiator on behalf of the deep state, or is there something else you would suggest?
So I absolutely would like Corey to be over there. But I almost entirely agree with Corey, maybe entirely, but here's an asterisk to what she said. I think it very much in line with Corey's comment that if you are negotiating, you have to be willing to give some things up as well in order to get the things that you want, and that we should be thinking about, you know, what are the if you will, the carrots for the Iranians, because if it's all stick, they're just going to say, well, screw you. What's the point of all this? I mean, and that's how Trump treated them, right? It was all stick. We told them to get lost. And now we're sort of saying, oh, no, come back, except we still aren't going to give you any carrots. I don't want to keep going with this tortured metaphor, but you get the idea. The only thing I would add, though, is that I think that we, the U.S., in almost every situation with almost every other country, we consistently underestimate the power of nationalism. And when we impose sanctions or do things that are humiliate Iranian leaders in front of their own people, when we do things that make Iranians suffer, when we do things that make Iranians feel like we are humiliating Iran, that creates a more hardline Iranian public, which enables more hardline Iranian leaders, and in fact, sometimes forces Iranian leaders to be more hardline themselves because they have to answer to their own domestic constituencies. We consistently, whether it's, you know, thinking about military and political strategy on the ground in Iraq during the Iraq War, or, you know, Vietnam, I mean, go back, pick anything you want, that we tend to forget that other people are as nationalistic as we are in the United States. And, you know, if somebody said to us, you're not allowed to have any more nuclear weapons, even those of us who think we shouldn't have any nuclear weapons would probably be saying, oh, yeah, well, screw you. You know, you don't get to tell us what we get to have and what we don't get to have. And the Iranians react in the same way. And, I think it's tricky. It's an incredibly difficult challenge, you know, because we obviously also aren't going to say, OK, sure, you know, do whatever you want. But find, you know, threading that needle where we are responding in a way that simultaneously says, hey, look, there are some things that are not OK that would generate a U.S. response of the type you would not want and you would regret, while essentially letting everybody keep their dignity, I think has got to be an essential part of the process, because otherwise, I think we do create a situation where even if Iranian leaders themselves would like to say, yeah, we can accept that, they then think, oh, we can't do that because we're going to get too much flack from our own domestic constituencies. So we have to take a harder line, and that doesn't help anybody.
David, at the beginning, you described reasons why these negotiations might not work. We've now had a bit of a discussion about strategies for making something out of this. What's a scenario in your mind where you could actually have a positive outcome to the negotiations? And what would it look like in terms of Iran's final deal? Do they freeze where they are? Do they have to go back a bit? How far back do they have to go back for it to be worth the U.S. and the others to make concessions?
David, it's exactly the right question. And in recent weeks, we've seen some evidence that Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, some of his counterparts have been kicking around the idea of what would a nuclear freeze temporary deal look like. And basically what that would do would be to get the Iranians to stop production now in return for some modest relaxation of sanctions. The Israelis would scream that we are allowing Iran to hold on to 60% enriched uranium. And our response to that would be, well, you just read in Axios, they're thinking about going to 90%. Better to have 60% that's not quite bomb grade than 90% that is. Then the question is, does that actually get you back to the old deal? And remember, it was only in June that we thought there was general agreement that we would go back to the old deal, and that would mean that Iran would ship out of the country the most of the uranium that it has produced in the past 2 years in response to the Trump decision to get out of the deal. It's hard for me to imagine right now this government in Iran agreeing to go back to where we were in 2015. Remember, they got elected under a banner that basically said the old government was a sucker to take the old deal. Remember that the Iran deal is as unpopular in Iran as it was in the U.S. Congress for exactly the reasons that Rosa laid out, that it appeared to be giving up a fair bit of sovereignty. So clearly, we're going to have to make some offers to the Iranians. That's going to be politically very difficult for President Biden, because not only will he be charged by the Republicans with giving up on some sanctions when the Iranians are outside the deal, he's going to get charged with that by some Democrats Remember, the opponents of the original deal included Chuck Schumer, Menendez, many other sort of Iran hardliners, big supporters of Israel in the Senate, who thought that the deal that Obama struck was a bad one. Biden does not have a whole lot of room out here. And I think the best thing they could come up with would be a freeze, which would basically be saying, if you're in a hole, stop digging.
Yeah, or maybe they could get a freeze plus a little more than that in the future at some point, if both sides feel that everybody is holding to that agreement, along with what Corey was talking about earlier, which is a commitment from the United States to defend our allies.
That's absolutely right, but that's very different from the longer and stronger.
It is very different. But, you know, if that's not a possibility, then what we have to discuss what is a possibility. And that's what you guys have done so expertly, as you do every week. And that is one of the things that I, of course, was thankful for last Thursday and hope to continue to be thankful for a long, long time to come. As I said earlier, we've got a lot of exciting stuff coming up in the weeks ahead. Go to the DSR Network to find out more of it. In the meantime, I want to thank David. I want to thank Corey. I want to thank Rosa. I want to thank all of you for listening. And as we have a new resurgence of COVID out there, wherever you are, be careful. Bye-bye.